Welcome back to Pemba On Demand, podcast for the alumni and friends of the University of Tennessee's Physician Executive MBA program, where we explore the intersection of medicine, business, and leadership. Today, I'm joined by a true Renaissance physician, Dr. Tom Loeb, surgeon, innovator, entrepreneur, and now founder of the T.E. Loeb Family Foundation, a unique structure blending purpose, philanthropy, and some pretty bold financial strategy. From pioneering stem cell treatments for autism, to launching high-end concierge anti-aging services, to developing a wearable AI device for infant health monitoring, Dr. Loeb's work is as wide-ranging as it is unconventional. But behind it all is a foundation that quietly powers his vision. We're going to dig into why he created the foundation, how it's structured, and what it's allowed him to do that traditional models wouldn't, and the lessons he's learned that just might help other physicians like you think about launching their own. So whether you're dreaming of funding breakthrough care models, launching a socially conscious startup, or just curious how a family foundation can shift your career trajectory, this episode is for you. Let's get into it. Welcome to Pemba On Demand, Physician Leaders Making a Difference. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians seeking professional development. We discuss a wide range of topics on the podcast, including successful innovations in a variety of healthcare disciplines, current issues in healthcare career development, and healthcare leadership. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries, most of whom graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute professional advice. The views and opinions expressed by the host and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the University of Tennessee or any other organization. By listening to this podcast, you acknowledge and agree to these terms. Whether you're sipping your morning coffee, commuting to the hospital, or just looking for a dose of inspiration, we've got you covered. We hope you will take full advantage of these practical, insightful, and relevant discussions designed to help physician leaders get new and build upon existing leadership skills and perspectives. Pemba On Demand will allow you to be an even bigger force for good in healthcare. Tom, welcome to Pemba On Demand.
Thank you for inviting me, Norman. Happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you here. I've been looking forward to recording this episode with you for some time now. I think it's going to be some great content for our viewers.
So I'm ready. Ready when you are.
All right. We're going to talk today about your family foundation, the T.E. Loeb Family Foundation. Maybe we could start at the beginning and you could tell us a little bit about exactly what inspired you to create the foundation.
Sort of an interesting story. So I was talking to someone trying to figure out a combination of asset protection and tax savings. And he let me know about a concept that I ended up checking out with my accountants and attorneys and everybody just to make sure that it was all kosher. This doesn't work for W-2 income, but it works for anything. If you have a business, LLC, 1099 income, however you get money coming in, that's not a typical employment situation. And it's a series of trusts and foundations. And in a nutshell, there is the equivalent of a business trust, so that the business trust owns all of your 1099 income, or is the holder, the 100% or 99% owner of all your LLCs. And that money you can spend on all of the expenses related to your businesses and operations. And anything left over flows into a family trust. And these, by the way, are irrevocable trusts. It doesn't work with revocable trusts because somebody could attach that, especially if you are the you as an individual own that trust or are the trustee. And then at the end of the year, December 31st, anything that's in that family trust and not spent on family matters, you transfer to the foundation. I set it up as a family foundation. We can talk about about the reasons for that, but it could be an ordinary foundation as well. And the foundation rules are pretty simple. You just have to spend 5% of the holdings of that foundation in any given year. At the end of the year, the business trust files, and it's basically a two-page tax form. I think it's a 1043. I can't remember the exact number, but I could find out and let the listeners know. A family trust does a similar thing. So there's no assets in either of those two trusts to be taxed at the end of the year. And then anything that is at the foundation can basically stays in the foundation, except for the 5% that you have to give to charity or as a grant from the foundation. The foundation's very specific. You can't spend money on yourself. I couldn't spend mortgage money. I couldn't spend rent. You can pay a salary from the foundation for operating it or for directing it, but then that gets taxed, so that kind of defeats the purpose. And so when he told me this concept, I said, well, there's some things that I want to do. And so I could use a foundation to help fund things that are meaningful to me, that serve my personal mission, my family's mission, my goals in life, create a legacy. So that's how that came about. And so the trusts are just sit there, and they're functional and operational. And my accountant has, deals with that every year now. But the foundation is really a personal love and personal mission, and sort of took on a life of its own, and created it, set up the missions, which I'm a pediatric surgeon. I've been taking care of kids for 50 years, and so all of my missions is stated in the foundation website and in its mission statement relate to the welfare of children and to benefit children around the world. And we can talk about what those are. It's very gratifying, the whole concept. So I basically, for all of my income that's not W-2, which is the majority of my income these days, because I'm basically cutting down on my medical practice from the university. The foundation is basically where I want to devote my time and spend my money, and hopefully for the good of the kids around the world. And that's how that all came about.
It sounds like, and I would love to hear a little bit more about what the foundation's mission is. You mentioned your background as a pediatric surgeon. Was it your background as a pediatric surgeon that sort of formed this idea in your mind to create a foundation to help kids? Or were there other personal experiences that you had or other situations that kind of drove this as well?
Having a life mission to help kids ever since I was young, and since I got started, when I donate to any cause, and have been for my charitable contributions, even to my temple, I direct it specifically to kids education, sending kids to camp, doing something related to kids. Mission of the foundation is pretty clear. The three main missions as part of it, they could expand. I actually had a dream last night that I may expand it in another similar direction. I may add something to it, but they're currently three main missions. One of them is to help early childhood education for communities or schools or situations that are disadvantaged in some way, and just to kind of help. If kids don't get a good start, then they don't end up having a good life, at least in my way of thinking. So I want to make sure kids get a good start with their childhood education. That could be for teacher salaries, for support for books, whatever the schools need. And so part of the task of the foundation directors and the staff is to kind of help find worthy educational institutions or communities that need funding. And that's sort of interesting, because that gets into getting their tax information, their income, just to prove that they're needy. And so that's one of the missions. There's another thing that I do, and that's perhaps a whole other discussion. We started talking about that the other day. I have a stem cell interest, and have been working with stem cells actually for probably over 40 years. I started out working with kids with stem cell transplants when I was spent 25 years at St. Jude, and that has evolved into more of a point of care type stem cell situation. And I got approached by a physician from the UK in about 2015, and said, "Listen, I understand stem cells can be helpful for kids with autism. Would you treat my
child if I come from the UK to Chicago and have you treat him. And so I said, I don't see why not. I looked into it and it wasn't very harmful. So since about 2015, I've treated hundreds of kids now with autism. They find me. I don't advertise this, obviously. As things have evolved now, we now have a way that's consistent with FDA guidelines that makes it legal, if you will. Yeah, prior to that, it was sort of on the edge, and but I've been treating kids with stem cells. We have a viable option for that, and so one of the missions is to help fund kids' treatment with stem cells for again families who are needy and can't really afford it. And I've been fortunate. I've actually had some donors who are interested to help support that. So if somebody has, you know, one of my missions that is a particular interest or a particular focus for them, I'm happy to direct the funds that they donate to support their interest. And then the third one is actually, I guess, my main focus. I'm sort of a dreamer, perhaps an innovator. I'd like to think that. I had this idea that if we had a better way to detect when a child is ill in a significant way to get them to medical attention, that we may improve infant mortality. So I've been working now for the last 5 months with a team of engineers to develop a novel neonatal monitor that fits like a little sandal on the foot of a newborn baby, and it measures everything. It measures, you know, heart rate variability, pulse oximetry, temperature, respirations, movement. I mean, you can tell if the kids, you know, are laying with face up, face down, standing on the head. It's a very sophisticated system, all designed using AI. And the AI is built into the device rather than there's some existing devices that they're trying to retrofit, and they have data. They send it up to the cloud, analyze it, and send it back to the parents. Well, this basically goes directly from the infant's foot to the parent's app. And the intention is to warn them when there's a problem. And sort of timely this morning, I searched through the news, and I think it was Washington Post just published an article that was a study done by a friend of mine here in Chicago looking at Fitbits. And it turns out that, for as an example, in this study, kids who wore Fitbits could pick up postoperative complications. I'm a surgeon, so this was of interest to me. 3 to 6 days before an adverse event would be apparent otherwise. And it actually saved emergency room visits and saved hospitalization costs. And so it's really early detection of problems. So we want to do the same thing for infants. And so part of the mission or this mission in my foundation is to help develop this device. We'll have a prototype probably in about 30 days, get it into manufacturing, get it to market, ultimately get it through FDA approval for the things that require that, and do those studies and, you know, create a business out of it. So again, because this has the potential to save lives, you know, I want to be able to make it affordable to the general population, and actually to use the foundation to kind of help pay for devices for populations that can't afford it and need it. Because I think, to me, having good healthcare is a right. It shouldn't be a privilege. So you know, parents, I think, have the right to be able to identify when their child's ill enough to seek medical attention. And unlike other baby monitors out there, this is, I mean, if you want to get down to the nitty-gritty and look at every little change in heartbeat, every change in respiration, temperature fluctuate, you can do that. But it's really designed as an app just to warn the parents that, hey, you know, we've measured this kid's baseline. We know what that is. The kid's enough off a baseline that you might want to call the doctor and get your kid to see some attention from a healthcare professional and find out why he's so off baseline.
Can you fund the R&D for this through the foundation, or is it more providing, once it's developed, that you can provide the devices to needy patients through the foundation donations or grants or that type of thing?
Both really. So right now we're doing the R&D, paying the salaries of the people. Or it's not really salaries. They're doing jobs. The engineers are designing it. We have to pay them to do the design. These are design engineers, electrical engineers, AI engineers. Currently, I'm funding it through myself. So I'm making tax deductible contributions to my own foundation, which helps me at the end of the day and helps defer tax expenses, and it goes to a good cause. I'm not benefiting directly from this, but serving my mission. So that was the impetus for this, and so right now, for the last 5 months, we've been going on my dime, and hopefully we'll get the support from other people who are interested. And we're not looking for venture capital funds just yet. I mean, if we can kind of get grants. Support as far as we can through grants. We'd prefer that, obviously. We've got a very small core team working on it. I'm providing some medical direction. I've got an AI engineer who's got 20 years experience developing medical devices, and he's working on that. His team's in Nepal, and although he's based in Chicago, so we get to meet him face to face. And then I have a young industrial engineer who's in charge of the project, and she's kind of herding the cats and making them all go in the right direction, so that we get the project completed. And she's very efficient at and very frugal and not spending money frivolously. So a little bit has gone a long way so far.
Great. So getting back to the structure of the foundation, is the Family Foundation different in any way than a traditional or a donor-advised foundation fund?
A couple of things. I think, first of all, most family foundations either focus on a particular family mission, set of goals, or are run exclusively by the family. And Illinois is interesting. When I set this up, it was easy to set the foundation up online. Cost me $1,000. I kind of set that up. They did all the work and the initial tax filings. I set it up in Illinois. In Illinois, you have to have three directors. So I picked three directors. I serve as a director. My office manager, who had an interest in working with the foundation, doing some work, requested to be one of the directors. And then another colleague of mine, who's a close friend, also serves as a director. So the directors, except for me, aren't family. And ultimately, when my kids will get involved, they'll take it over eventually after I step down. But the Family Foundation, in this sense, is more of a family or personal goal type of foundation. A conventional foundation with a board and external directors sort of runs autonomously and doesn't necessarily have to listen to the family. But both of them can receive funds from public sources. In most cases, a family foundation is funded mostly by the family, but they can take external funding. A more conventional foundation is just receiving funds and can go out and solicit and request donations. So I'm not really doing that except for personal friends and people I know. To say, hey, we have this foundation. You can set it up. Both of them get the same charitable donation benefits tax wise. So it's a 503C foundation that can be deducted from your taxes as appropriate. So and you just have to file the right forms for both of them. They're slightly different forms for a family foundation, which is considered a private foundation as opposed to a public foundation. So the tax forms are slightly different.
Well, thank you for that explanation. This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podpodcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. I guess one of the other questions that came to my mind as I was talking about it, it sounds like you do have to have some attorney, accountant involvement in this. How do you know going into it that it is going to benefit you enough compared to the expense of maintaining the foundation and the trusts? It seems like they would all have some expense. So how did you make the decision that ultimately this would be a cost-effective or a feasible way for you to structure what you were trying to achieve?
Sure. So first I asked my accountant if it made sense. And I said, this is what I want to do. This is what I was told will work. Was I told correctly? And the answer was yes. And so that was simple. That was just a discussion with my accountant. It just means three returns, besides whatever other returns that you have. So I have to have a separate return, which are usually just a couple page returns for the trust for each of the two trusts, and then an appropriate return for the foundation. So that's the accountant end of things. The attorney, again, through some friends of mine, I found trusts are interesting. And there's all sorts of different trusts. And so what you want for asset protection, an irrevocable trust that can't be breached. And so there is a particular trust. And I can get the name for you, and you can add that in offline. But there is a Nevada trust that hasn't been breached in over 100 years. It's a particular irrevocable trust. It vests after 2 years. So once it's been in existence 2 years, nobody can touch it. So it's a really nice way to keep the fund. So if you get sued, for example, for malpractice or something like that, they can't attach the irrevocable trust. It's sort of an interesting trust because you have to own property in Nevada to be eligible for it. That property just amounts to being a bank account that's considered ownership. One of the trustees has to live in Nevada. And so the attorney who set it up serves that purpose for me. And so he can do that. So in that trust, I think it was under $1,000 to form each of the trusts. Because he does these quite frequently, and so it wasn't a lot of money to set up the trust. It's a fairly standard vehicle. Those were set up, and other than the initial expense, the tax returns every year, it's not that expensive. Obviously, saves you money in taxes.
Have there been any drawbacks or limitations that you've encountered, or things that you'd wish you'd known earlier as you've gone through this process?
The original guy who offered to set the trust, I believe, set him up wrong. And so I basically took the information I learned from that experience, had somebody who knows what they're doing, set it up properly. So I started down one path and kind of switched gears. The first trust weren't irrevocable trust. And I realized sort of after the fact that, it's better to be an irrevocable trust. So nobody can touch. I found that out the hard way in a divorce where her attorneys said, well, you're a trustee, so I can get this money out of this trust account. And I didn't know that could happen. So, some lessons you learn the hard way. So irrevocable trust is the way to go. And you shouldn't be the sole trustee. So that makes a difference. Yeah. So I learned some things about the mechanics. So if you find somebody who knows what they're doing, they can kind of help you set it up properly. Otherwise, I have no regrets. To date, it all seems to be working.
Great. One of the questions I had as we've been talking and as we've been kind of preparing for this podcast, is it an accurate statement to say that the revenue or compensation, it's not a salary because it's not W-2 income, but it's coming into your LLCs or into your corporations, that money flows into the trust first and then at some point gets transferred into the family foundation. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So what happens? So all of my LLCs, either any new LLCs I set up afterwards or LLCs that I had in existence, I have switched the ownership of those. It's the trust that owns them, not me personally. Okay. So if I set up a new Pemba LLC as a name, then it wouldn't be me as the member manager. It would be the trust that's the member manager. And so that any money that comes in from any source, from any of those LLCs, and I've got about 15 right now from different businesses that I've gotten involved in. They've all been switched over. And so all that money flows into this business trust first. And anything related to those businesses, maintaining them, fees, expenses, legal, office operations, anything, I pay out of the monies that come into there out of that before I transfer it out. And the family foundation, I can pay for anything related to family. So that could be expenses for myself from home, could be food, could be paying things related to my kids. Anything that's a family matter can be funded through the family trust. And then at the end of the year, there's
those trusts are zeroed out. There's nothing in those trusts. The bank accounts are empty. The books, show a bunch of goose eggs and zeros, and anything left over, goes into the foundation.
And then the foundation is the vehicle that, as you mentioned earlier, has to at least spend 5% of its income annually. The money that's in the foundation has to be expended annually, 5%, I believe you said.
Right. So you can, any money beyond that 5%, if you choose not to spend it, can just accumulate interest and grow. Okay. So this infant mortality project, the device we're working on, is kind of needy right now. So most of the monies have been, coming in and going out related to that. And I've actually taken some funds along the way as needed and to help fund the foundation, so I could actually use the foundation to support through a grant company that's working on this device.
And for the foundation, is there a limit to the types of things that the foundation money can be expended on once it gets into the foundation?
Yeah, it has to be consistent with the mission. So right now, I could support staff. So if, in other words, if I hire staff to help decide what educational institutions are worthy and needy, looking at their finances, I can pay that staff a salary. I could pay myself a salary and could pay the directors for if there was enough money into it to do that. But I could pay an office for the foundation or any other expenses that are needed. Other than that, it has to be consistent with the mission and it has to be stated. And so if you look, there's a website for the foundation, the loebfoundation.org. You can show it up there, and it's got the missions clearly stated and the goals. So I can spend monies related to those missions, but I couldn't say, hey Norm, let's go fishing and use the foundation money to pay for that fishing trip.
So what does the auditing process look like for the foundation in terms of making sure that the money is being dispersed in a way that's consistent with you? Foundation.
There is a federal form you have to submit every year just to make sure that it's consistent with the goals of the foundation. The feds take a look at that, and you have to keep pretty good accounting. So everything comes in. In most cases, I know where the money's going. They basically the equivalent of submitting a grant or made a request, and it's consistent with the mission and the purpose of the foundation. So the foundation has funded those. And I've done the same thing for all three of its missions right now. I mentioned that I might add another mission. I actually had a dream about supporting some kids for a cancer treatment that wasn't supported otherwise. And again, it's a mission related to children. So I may add that as a fourth mission, and that's okay to do. But again, it's not paying for our fishing trip, Norm. Sorry about that.
Understood. Well, and you mentioned that right now your family, your kids, they're not really involved in the Family Foundation, but it sounds like that's something that you really envision as the future for this Family Foundation. And do they share the same passion that you do for these types of initiatives, or is this something that you think they may have their own projects and passions that you'd be perfectly comfortable with this Family Foundation focusing on as you leave it as a legacy for them?
I have two great kids, unfortunately. One is a family physician, and she has two little children of her own, a 3- and a 5-year-old, who are my pride and joy. And they live in Scottsdale, but I she's got her hands full right now, so she's not ready to take on the responsibility of getting involved. She could barely keep up with her kids and where they're supposed to be and all their activities. And then my other daughter has expressed an interest in the foundation, and she and I are in discussions about actually bringing her on as one of the staff to help look at how to disperse funding. So she actually, she'd probably be the one of the two of them to take over things at some point. And they know I'm all about kids, and I think they're okay with that. So
great. What would you say that besides the addition of oncology or cancer treatment therapy over the next 5 years, how would you describe your biggest goal for the foundation? Where do you want it to be 5 years from now? What would you like to see as outcomes from the foundation during that period of time?
Sure. So I have a private organization that I'm doing a dance with at the moment, and I've asked them for a $20 million donation to kind of help fund all the missions, and I've been keeping them abreast of what we're doing, and so my dream would be to actually get that grant, and hopefully I'll know before the end of October if that's actually going to happen or not, and then hire enough staff to kind of actually really make sure that the people who are requesting grants are appropriately needy. I want to use some of that money to help get this project off the ground. It's going to take a little bit of money to get it into production. It takes more money to market it. Probably $1.5 to $2 million to do the clinical studies to get the FDA approval. And so I see $3, $4, or $5 million expenses right away just for that one project. And hopefully, our goal is to get it into production by the end of the first quarter next year, and get it to market and get it into circulation, and then do the clinical study hopefully by the end of 2027. And I think the people who are in charge of that device ultimately would like to kind of get it to market, take it, build it up, and then sell it to a bigger company. There are a couple of bigger companies in that market. It's an interesting market. It's predicted by 2035 to be a $3.5 billion market, infant monitoring. And we're a unique device that does what no other device currently on the market does, and there are only about four or five of them on the market. So I think we have a good chance to become a market leader. At least that's one of the goals. So I'm hoping the foundation can help support that. And then as we get more and more into the autism treatment with stem cells to kind of support more kids, more families. These are not, it's like treating diabetes. You don't just give a shot of insulin. You have to take insulin every day. So these kids get stem cells on a monthly basis, or about every 6 weeks, roughly, for the rest of their lives. So I've had kids that I've been treating for 8, 9 years now. So it's an ongoing process, and each treatment ends up being, costing a few $1,000s. So you don't want to get the money in the foundation to continue to support that and support education where it can. So I think just those three missions alone is going to be a full-time endeavor.
Now, I had not really been aware of the use of stem cell therapy for autism. How did you get involved in that, and how did you become aware of the research and the data around the value of stem cells for autism?
So that's a story that actually Pemba got me into. You have to do your project, and I had this concept that I wanted to develop a practice model based on complementary and alternative medicine. And I did the demographics, and I said this is kind of a interesting type of therapy, and it's got to be in a place that's receptive to it. So I looked around, and California, seemed to be an appropriate place. I knew nothing about California, and I said that the people who are going to be able to afford it, it's going to be Beverly Hills. So I just totally blind went and opened up this practice in Beverly Hills, California. And then it was all based on complementary medicine and acupuncture and energy therapies and different things, and things that are actually coming now more into the forefront, and people recognize their value. But when I did this in 2008, 2007, 2008, they said, well, if insurance doesn't pay for this, how am I going to be able to afford it, right? And they didn't recognize the value of it. And so I had this beautiful office, and I had a staff, and I had all these interesting devices, and the people who understood it couldn't afford to pay a penny. And so well, that's not a very good business model. So I started asking people, what do they want? I said, if you don't want what I'm selling, what is it that you'll pay for? And well, let's see, they want to pay to look better. They want to pay to sleep better. They want to pay to keep their mind sharp. They want to pay for better sex. And I said, well, I can do all that. That's easy. And so I evolved into more of a regenerative medicine model. That's what they call it today, or anti-aging regenerative medicine. Back in about 2008, they were just beginning to talk about doing point of care stem cell therapy. And at that time, they were taking either bone marrow or fat from a little mini liposuction, processing it in the office on the spot, and giving it back and injecting into joints or IV or wherever. And so this all evolved in about 2008, 2010. I really started the doing these types of therapies and getting known for some of it. And as it turned out, I had several people with some sort of neurocognitive impairment, either autism or early cognitive impairment or Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, those sorts of things. And people say, well, will stem cells work on that? And the data suggested that it did. And the basis is basically an anti-inflammatory model, because in all of these neurocognitive disorders, autism included, there is inflammation of the neuroglial cells in the brain. These are like the macrophages in the brain, and they're basically on fire. And so if you can equate that inflammatory response in the brain to cellular noise and disruption, it's like going to the stadium and your team scores a touchdown and everybody's cheering. You turn to the person next to you and try and talk to them. They can't hear a word you're saying because there's too much noise. And that's exactly what goes on in the brain. And so the theory is that the stem cells quiet down this inflammation significantly and allow the cells to communicate better with one another more effectively. And you can actually see when you infuse stem cells, and this is just an IV infusion, into these kids, it's like somebody flipped on a light switch. You can see the look in their eyes. So it's like somebody turned on the lights, and all of a sudden they can see the world clearly. And the parents tell us that they start talking about things that they've never talked about before, talking about colors and things on the street that they see, and they perceive the world differently. And I think it's because we quiet the inflammation down enough. And it's a common issue or a common denominator for a number of the neurocognitive disorders. It's not the only thing. These are complex disorders, but it's certainly significant enough that at the very least, stem cells seem to be effective. And what we've learned over the years is it's not just a single treatment. They have to be repeat treatments, just like you're treating hypertension, diabetes, or anything that's chronic. It's just an ongoing sort of treatment. So depending on what we're talking about, it may be in every 6 or 8 week IV infusion. I've had some families, I can't afford that, so now it's every 3 months or so. I've had some that did it like once or twice a year. The only times it hasn't been effective is when people didn't persist with it. If people continue to get these treatments, it's like every time you treat it, you fill the glass half full. And so if you keep treating incrementally, you get more and more improvement. So it builds on itself. So we've noticed that with the autism kids, and it's been pretty effective. It's not 100%. It doesn't work on everybody. Just like a lot of therapies and drugs that we use in our clinical practice don't work on everyone. But it works more often than not, and it specifically works when we do repeat treatments. So that's why we got excited about it. And we now it used to be expensive. I mean, I used to have these parents come and they'd have to borrow money, sell their house, get a second mortgage, and because they were and I was using products that weren't I wasn't developing the office, I had to buy them. And to get the number of stem cells, because quantity seems to make a difference, it was very costly. I felt like I was working for these companies that were producing these umbilical cord cell products and amniotic fluid cell products and things like that. And now we have a much better model. We do a little mini liposuction. We send that tissue as a fat to the lab. The lab then grows these, takes the stem cells out of it and grows them in the lab. And basically, you have stem cells for life. And so you have an unlimited supply, and these stem cells come cryopreserved, shipped on dry ice with 10 million stem cells in a vial. It's about 2 cc's that you can stick into a joint, stick into an IV, use it intrathecally, however you decide to use the cells that are available. And the company just got approval for a phase 2b study for Crohn's disease, because it turns out you give it to these Crohn's patients and the disease just goes away. The strictures melt away. They became asymptomatic. It's pretty interesting. The FDA likes it because there's no adverse effects. Yeah, there's no toxicity. These cells are preserved in a sugar-based cryopreservative. It's no DMSO, no toxins, no thimerosal. It's basically just pure cells and sugar water. And so there's no toxicity. There's no adverse effects. We're using autologous cells, so they come from the patient themselves. In the case of the kids, we actually harvest one of the parents, because the FDA says we can do first or second degree relatives, and so they consider those autologous by their definition, published in their guidelines. So I can harvest from a parent and give it to the kid.
And so for the purposes of stem cell treatments, for example, if I harvested your norm, then you could actually use it on your elderly parents if they had some issue, or and you could use it on your children, which makes it a sort of a family investment. That's kind of a modest investment. So for $500 for 10 million stem cells that are yours, that's a pretty cheap price, and that's affordable now. So and when we're talking about these kids with autism, we're just talking about giving one, two, three vials per treatment. So these are affordable treatments, whereas before they used to cost tens of thousands. Now they're costing under $2,000 a treatment.
Great. Well, it sounds like an exciting area that you're working on, and it's kind of cool that you've found a way to set up the foundation to assist with that vision and the other visions that you have. I was wondering if I was a Pemba alum, fellow Pemba alum, or you had another physician who approached you and wanted to set up a foundation who had this kind of entrepreneurial mindset. What's the most important piece of advice that you would really want them to understand and hear first before they went down the same road that you headed down?
I think that you need to make sure that if you like the concept, that you have an attorney that you trust who knows what they're doing. And like I got lucky. I found one through a friend who was very inexpensive, and because he does so many of these, and very experienced in it. And he sent me all the legalities, and just so I understood it before I got into it, and understood all the pros and cons. So I think finding somebody you can trust. Making sure your accountant is all on board with it. So I think those are important things. And then, the foundation is easy to set up, but it's, and I guess it's LegalZoom.com. That's the company that does that. They make LLCs and things like that. So they also will do a foundation for you. For it's about $1,000 fee. It probably doesn't matter where you set that foundation up. It's a different sort of tax structure since it's all a charity. So a lot of people set things up in Nevada or Delaware or somewhere that's a tax benefit. The foundation matters less for that. So you may look into your local laws just to make sure there's no extra hoops that you have to go through when you're talking about foundation. Illinois had a couple that some other states didn't, but they were easy to overcome and not really any additional expense. And then just make sure that you have a mission in mind that makes sense to you. And so, and again, it doesn't have to be a family foundation, but that just made more sense for me because I wanted more control of the direction of the foundation. Because in another foundation, if you have some monies, they may decide to go off on some tangent that didn't necessarily, wasn't necessarily consistent with my goals.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned briefly earlier in the conversation your experience at Pemba in one way was when you were thinking about the complementary medicine track. I assume that was your part of your OAP that you did for Pemba.
Yeah, I call it CAMCARE.
Okay.
All the teachers said, "Hey, this is great. It's such a good model. You should do it." And that's really what got me into all this. I said, "Well, if anything is that good, maybe there's some teeth to it." So I went and borrowed some money and got an office in California and had a staff and took off on a new adventure. And I will say, being in an independent business for any of the Pemba members who have done such a thing, it's an interesting experience. And I've been through everything. I've been successful. I've been through bankruptcies. I've been even more successful after the bankruptcies and turned things around. So I could probably write the book on what to do and what not to do at this point. But it's I think I owe most of the knowledge and the drive and from the foundation that I got at Pemba. I think without that, I never would have going off in these ventures.
Great. Was this what drove you to Pemba in the first place? Was this entrepreneurial mindset that you had?
That was an accident. I was a faculty at the University of Tennessee in Memphis. I went to the American College of Surgeons meeting, and they had a booth there, and I just started talking to somebody. I just, do I get a break if I'm, faculty on already at University of Tennessee? Do I get a discount? Well, probably not, but I said, "Well, send me some information." I'm not sure what I filled out, but the next thing I knew, I got a box of books and said, "Here, be at this first class in January." And, I said, you know what the heck? I'm going to go, and if I don't like it, I'll say, hey, this was a mistake. I've been there a week. What can I lose? And I loved it, mostly because it was new. I love the people in the class. I love the instructors. It was such a unique experience, and so educational and beneficial. I'm a lifelong learner. I like to learn. Almost doesn't matter what it is. Novelty is sort of my drug of choice. So because it was new, different, it wasn't, surgery I knew pretty well, but business I didn't, and so I ended up in Pemba kind of by accident. By spending too long in a booth talking to somebody.
But it sounds like it was something that you really gravitated towards once you were there, and that brought you a tremendous amount of value in the long run.
It's the best thing I've ever done. With all the ups and downs, the people I've met, the experience, I've been really lucky. Most of my life, good people have come into my life, through my associations in Pemba, my staff. I don't think I've ever advertised for staff. People come to me and say, hey, listen, we like what you're doing. We looked at your website. Do you have room for somebody? I've been really fortunate that good people have just come my way, and so I've been lucky in that regard. I will say that the skills I learned in Pemba have taken me a long way. And as I said, I have about 15 LLCs, which is just a number of different businesses that I run. So I'm still full time in my surgical practice, and I still teach. And the residents tease me and say, Dr. Loeb, we think surgery is your side gig because you got all this other stuff going on, So.
Yeah, it must be hard to tell sometimes which one's the side gig and which one is your main hustle, I guess.
I tell people who will listen. I said, it's really, I got about five full-time jobs. So I'm full-time surgical practice. I still run the regenerative medicine operation. I'm involved with stem cells, where I'm involved in developing this new device for the baby monitor called Niso. You'll hear about that as the months come along. We'll get it out to market. And it's really been a very interesting experience. And I make time for them all. I love them all. I still get to spend time with my family and go fishing once a month down in Costa Rica and enjoy life. And I think I enjoy it because I'm so busy and because I do all these things.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, we appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today on Pemba On Demand. I look forward to maybe having you back on the show and hearing a little bit more about the pediatric monitor as it goes to market, those types of things. So we'll stay in touch and see when maybe we can give the audience a bit of an update on those things.
Absolutely. Well, I hope this is of value, and I can provide you with all the contacts and links to all the things that we talked about. If anybody's has an interest in pursuing this further, I'm happy to share what knowledge I've gained.
Yes, we'll put the links in the show notes. And Tom, if you don't mind, I'll maybe put your LinkedIn or one of your some contact information in the show notes as well so that people can reach out to you and get in touch with you if they have questions.
Absolutely. Really look forward to it.
That'd be great. Well, thank you again for joining me.
Norman, thanks so much.
That was Dr. Tom Loeb, a physician executive who's proving that medicine, innovation, and impact don't have to live in separate silos. From his early work in pediatric surgery to the creation of his family foundation, Dr. Loeb has shown us how thinking like an entrepreneur doesn't mean abandoning your values, it means scaling them. His foundation isn't just a tax strategy, it's a strategic engine that fuels projects with purpose, from autism therapies to AI-enabled infant monitors. Whether you're a Pemba alum already knee-deep in your own ventures, or just starting to imagine what your legacy might look like, today's conversation was a reminder that structure matters, strategy matters, and purpose matters most. You can learn more about Dr. Loeb's work at loebfoundation.org, and as always, you'll find links and takeaways in the show notes. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing and leaving a review. It helps more Pemba alumni discover the show and join the conversation.
Pemba On Demand is released bi-weekly, every other Thursday, and available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Castos, or Overcast. Please subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast player by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could share the podcast with your friends or colleagues. You can also listen to our podcasts on our YouTube channel, www.youtube.com/@PembaOn-demand, all one word, no spaces. Please hit the like button and subscribe. Also, if you have any comments or questions regarding this or other episodes, please feel free to add them into the comment section on our YouTube channel. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to our website and our YouTube channel in the show notes. The website is tiny.utk.edu/PembaOnDemand, all one word. There's no hyphen in that URL. You will find the links to the episodes there. Please also check the show notes for links that were discussed in the show today. Take good care of yourselves and become an even bigger force for good in healthcare.